I imagine that to most of you, my guests up here on the stage need very little introduction. I'll give you briefly their background. From left to right, and I'm talking geography, not politics, is Bob Kimmitt. He is the founding chairman of the Deloitte Center for Cross-Border Investment. He was American ambassador to Germany from 91 to 93, Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs from 89 to 91, and general counsel to the U.S. Treasury from 85 to 87. He served as the White House as National Security Counsel, Executive Secretary and General Counsel from 83 to 85. Hans-Dietrich Genscher is the former foreign minister from the Federal Republic of Germany. He's a graduate of the University of Leipzig, where he studied law and economics. Mr. Genscher became a member of the German Bundestag in 1965, and 4 years later he became the Federal Minister of the Interior. In 1974, he was appointed Federal Minister for Foreign Affairs and Deputy Federal Chancellor, and I think I'm right in saying that you are the longest-serving foreign minister in German history. Is that right? Brent Scowcroft is on my left. He is the president of the Scowcroft Group. He served as the national security advisor to both Presidents Ford and George Bush Sr. From 1982 to 1989, he was vice chairman of Kissinger Associates, an international consulting firm. He has a long history in the U.S. military, and his Air Force service included a stint as professor of Russian history at West Point. He was assistant air attaché in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, and head of the political science department of the Air Force Academy. He was also special assistant to the director of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and military assistant to President Nixon. Thank you all, gentlemen, for joining me. Mr. Genscher, if I can start with you, at what point did you think that German unification was a realistic prospect?
I met Gorbachev for the first time in 86. And when I left the Kremlin, I said to my closest collaborator, when this man will do everything he has committed to do, then for the first time we have a real chance to reach our national objective, the reunification. When? Nobody could say, but we felt that the policy he announced would lead in the right direction, and whatever his motives were for the internal change in the Soviet Union, the outcome was foreseeable, because losing the tensions, the pressure on the satellites would immediately change the situation in the satellite states, in particular in East Germany, because the so-called German Democratic Republic had no national identity. It was the qualitative difference to Poland and to other states. But if you look what happened in 89, this was a totally new development. We could monitor in 53 the peaceful revolution in East Germany on the 7th of June 53, and the Soviet tanks left the barracks and brought down the demonstrations. The same happened in 56 in Hungary, in 68 in Czechoslovakia, and then the Solidarność in Poland came up. We should not forget the important role of the late Pope, who was encouraging people fighting for freedom and religious freedom, but civil rights. So the development had gone that far. And then Gorbachev came, and with his words, perestroika, and so this more or less showed this new policy. And then in Hungary, the socialist government used this opportunity to change the country. Hungary made this very courageous decision in summer 89 to open the borders to Austria for 10,000 of German refugees. It was a courageous decision because they couldn't know what the reaction from the Kremlin would be, but they did it, and the Kremlin tolerated it. And so I was convinced there will be no European unification without German unification. But in 89, everything was different, because in Hungary, in Poland, in Czechoslovakia, in GDR, people demonstrated for freedom. It was not a German revolution, it was not a Polish revolution, it was a European revolution, and I think the peoples of Europe never were so close together in their wishes and in their feeling as they were in the end of 89 and 90. We never should forget, because this is the heritage of this peaceful revolution for Europe, forever stick together.
In 86, Brent, did people in Washington start seeing the beginning of the end? Was that time frame what we were working with as well?
A little later, but by the time President Bush Sr. came into office, there were a lot of people saying, well, the Cold War's over. And we didn't think the Cold War was over at that time. The Cold War quintessentially was the division of Europe, and Soviet troops were still everywhere in Eastern Europe. So we saw the growing ferment in all of Eastern Europe, and we thought we should encourage that with the goal first of getting Soviet troops out, and then maybe the Cold War could end. We wanted to encourage the liberalizing regimes, especially in Poland and in Hungary. But we wanted to do it at a pace which would not bring about Soviet reaction as happened in Germany in 53, Hungary in 56, Czechoslovakia in 68. We didn't know exactly what that was, so we were sort of feeling our way. How much should we encourage Eastern Europe? How much should we be cautious so as not to bring out a Soviet?
And how good was our intelligence? How much did we know about what was the... When Hans Dietrich says that he spoke to Gorbachev and came away thinking, right, this is the beginning of the end.
My personal feeling. I spoke out in public on the 1st of February, 87, in Davos, on the occasion of the World Economic Summit, and I said we should take Gorbachev serious. We should take in on his words. We should not miss a historic chance. I was very much criticized, but I had the impression one should give support to him in order to encourage to go ahead with his policy. He had the intention to reform the system. He had not the intention to overcome socialism. Mm-hmm. He believed one can reform socialism, but later he learned, and he would being here would immediately state this, later he had to learn you could not reform socialism, you could only overcome socialism. This happened in 89.
Bob, you and I were sitting chatting earlier, and this idea about how much we knew what was happening, and I asked you where you were, and you said you were sitting in your office in Washington at the time, at the State Department, and we didn't know. We hadn't this. It all happened so fast for us watching from the outside world. It seemed to happen so fast that we didn't even have a chance to get there to see the actual event. We weren't there when the wall came down because we hadn't realized it was going to happen that fast. Was our intelligence good enough in the years leading up to it that we knew what was going to happen and that we saw the end coming?
I think even the best intelligence is an imprecise art. I actually think our political and security intelligence was relatively good. I think our economic intelligence was not as strong. I think the situation both in former East Germany and elsewhere in the Warsaw Pact was a lot less advanced than our and others' intelligence had led us to believe. But recall two things. First, my predecessor as ambassador in Bonn, Dick Walters, in the spring of 1989 had said extemporaneously in a set of remarks that he expected Germany to be unified during his tenure. He got quite a bit of criticism for being ahead of the curve.
For me.
I didn't want to point any fingers, but God rest Dick's soul, he saw something that perhaps the others of us didn't see. But I would say by the fall of 1989, there was a momentum that was developing because of the brave young men and women on the streets in Leipzig and elsewhere throughout the then Warsaw Pact. So much so, and Brent will remember this, that on October 24th, President Bush was interviewed by Johnny Apple of the New York Times. And the headline the next day, so 15 days before the wall fell, said that President Bush was not alarmed about the prospect of German unification, that he trusted Germany to move in a direction that would maintain its commitment to the alliance. By coincidence, that evening I was having dinner with my counterparts from the EU Troika, and the French political director said to me, "Mr. Kimmett, there's a lot of talk in Europe about the possibility of German unification. Have you thought about this in Washington?" And I said, "Well, the president certainly has." I took out the article, handed it to him, and he said, "Well, I know that's what the president said, but what do you really feel about this?" And I think that to some degree, the direction that the president set, and that is by showing a calmness about this, confidence in Germany to move in the right direction, that is, to be unified within the alliance. And then he mentioned in the interview also the need, obviously, to pay attention to French, British, Soviet interests, really sort of helped set the tone, even though none of us would have anticipated perhaps that the wall would fall just 15 days later. Nonetheless, to some degree, we had been giving our marching orders 2 weeks before.
Hans-Dietrich, how important was that? How important was the messages coming out of the White House here from President Bush and from your European counterparts as well?
We were confident that the United States will support. We were sure that President Mitterrand would support German unification under one condition, under the condition that Germany will stay in NATO and in the European Community. On the 30th of November, I was in Paris, and I had a meeting with Mitterrand, and my question was, what's the position of France concerning German unification? I said, we are in favor of that, but I have to ask you, Mr. Minister, will the United Germany continue the European way of the Federal Republic of Germany? This was important for him. Different was the position of Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, but this was not really a reason for concern for me, because I was convinced finally she will join the American line. So everything was dependent on you.
And did you have the vision, Brent? Were you responding event by event in the White House, or was there a strategy for?
Well, it was both. It was both. We had been thinking internally within the administration since the summer of 89 about the possibility of German unification. We listened carefully to the internal German debate, which was, yes, it ought to go fast, no, it ought to go slowly, and so on. And so we had the same kind of divisions in the government. Also looked at our allies. I would have said Mitterrand was not quite so enthusiastic as you say, but certainly Margaret Thatcher.
He was not against. If he was intestate, I don't know.
Okay. But Margaret Thatcher, and I'm not quoting, but I think she said something like, I like Germany so much I think there should be two of them. And certainly the Soviet Union was not in favor of it. So we had difficult ground here to convey, but I think the president, deep down inside, was pretty confident. And when he and Chancellor Kohl, in December of 89, had dinner just before a NATO meeting.
In Brussels.
Yes,
in Brussels.
Yes. And Chancellor Kohl laid out his plan for unification. The president surprised me a lot. He said, I have faith in you. I like what you say. Go for it. Just like that. And that decided any internal debate in the United States about the course.
And what sort of conversations were you having with Gorbachev whilst this was happening? How were you giving assurances to Moscow that NATO wouldn't expand?
Well,
we were trying,
and as I say, our concern about Gorbachev was you know, we thought probably he was the best we could have in the Kremlin. So we wanted,
a man you could do business with.
That's right. We wanted to preserve him, and we were afraid not only of a general Soviet reaction to this liberal move, but maybe the conservatives in the Soviet Union overthrowing Gorbachev. Now, that attempt was made, but it was made too late in the course of events. So that's what we were concerned about. Yes, we talked with Gorbachev. He actually was a supporter of liberalization in Eastern Europe.
It was his initiative.
It was. And so he encouraged that. He encouraged it really, I think, until the wall came down. Then he got nervous and was much more cautious.
And so, in those days before the wall came down, literally in the run-up to it, were you on the phone to the Kremlin hourly, daily?
Oh, well, I wouldn't say daily, but frequently, yes. Yes, and we watched with great interest Gorbachev's visit to East Germany on the 40th anniversary of their independence. Because East Germany was a bastion of conservatism at that time. Honecker was absolutely unyielding. And what would Gorbachev do when he went to visit the GDR? Would he support Honecker? Would he pull the rug out from under him? He didn't do either one, but his support was lukewarm enough that it, I think, opened the gates. And so Gorbachev was absolutely key there. But I think he became worried that events could get out of hand and go too fast.
And did he ask for and get specific assurances on NATO?
Well, no. That was unification and Germany and NATO were sort of on separate tracks. But the issue on NATO with Gorbachev was a fantastic event. He was visiting Washington in May of 1990, and the issue came up of unified Germany, and the unification process was moving at that time, of a unified Germany in NATO, and he wouldn't answer the president. So the president turned to the Helsinki Final Act, which said that members can choose whatever alliance they want to belong to. And he says, do you believe that should apply to Germany? And Gorbachev said, yes. Well, his colleagues at the table just went into a ferment, and they actually stopped the meeting, went over to a corner of the meeting room, and had a whispered conversation, came back. The president asked the question again, and Gorbachev tried not to answer. And he says, well, he says, this is a difficult issue. I think we should turn it over to our foreign ministers to discuss. And Shevardnadze said, oh, no. Oh, no. This is a matter for the heads of state. And that's what really broke the ice there.
I think that you refer to the Final Act of Helsinki that
yes.
shows how important this document was. It was underestimated and underrated in the West. During the negotiations concerning this final act, the German delegation insisted that this phrase should be included. Every signature country has a right to choose a defense union or the defense organization, and so we could refer during the year 90 on this phrase, and we doing what we are permitted by the Final Act of Helsinki. The talks we had were limited on Germany as a whole. In the talks we had, the 2+4 talks, it was not mentioned what would happen with Czechoslovakia or with Poland, just limited on Germany. And for us was important that United Germany will remain member of European Community and of NATO. But we made a different status in the east of Germany, former GDR. We agreed, the West agreed, that no Allied troops will deployed in the east of Germany, just German troops, but in NATO integrated German troops, not national units integrated German troops. So I think this was absolutely clear, but we had no mandate to discuss the question if Poland or Czechoslovakia or Hungary could become member or not. This was not on our table in this negotiation.
It wasn't on anybody's table at that point.
No, I think so, yes.
Bob, I know you want to pick up on what Brent was saying earlier, but I also want to ask you, when you went to Germany as ambassador in 91, as America's first post-war ambassador, what were your expectations for the country then, for a unified Germany?
I think that I shared at a personal level that the confidence that had been expressed by the president in Germany finding the right way forward, whether it be on political security or economic financial issues. I arrived in Germany in August of 1991, less than 10 days after the coup attempt against Gorbachev, at a time that the situation in the Balkans was getting more and more serious, and at a time when the costs of German unification were becoming more apparent. And just as a reminder, there's now been a net transfer of almost $2 trillion from west to east to try to extend the social safety net and create opportunity in the east. So the Germans had been on a bit of a roller coaster in that period, 89, 90. And when I got there in 91, it was a little bit on the downside. I would say things were more subdued in Hamburg on the first anniversary of unification than they obviously had been on Unification Day. But there was a quiet determination. The message that we wanted to send was that Germany was an important partner, both bilateral and alliance partner during the Cold War, and even more important partner in this period, the post-Cold War period that we were moving into. We didn't really know what to call the period. We knew it was after the Cold War. We weren't quite sure what we had stepped into.
There was no discussion about whether the fall of the wall might have obviated the need for a strong German-American alliance.
No, I think to the contrary. The Chancellor used to talk about the need to add new lanes to the transatlantic relationship, and there might have been more of an economic and financial focus to balance what had been a very strong security and political focus during the course of the Cold War, but I doubt the President would have sent me to Germany. I wouldn't have been interested in going if we weren't looking to take the relationship to the next level in a Europe that was looking to come together but had many years of difficult tasks in front of it. And ultimately, the German-American relationship was as important as any bilateral relationship that we had in securing that result. I would just step back just on your question on Gorbachev. If you take a look at what happened from January 20th, 89 up through November 9th of 1989, we had a very active relationship with the Soviets on a broad range of issues, as did the Germans. We had our arms control agenda, we had our bilateral agenda, trade, human rights, and then also the regional agenda. Remember, the last of the Soviet forces came out of Afghanistan in the late winter of 1989. We had Cubans leaving Central America and Angola. We had Vietnamese leaving Cambodia. We had East Germans leaving Eritrea. And that general retreat from what had been a very aggressive regional posture had to be managed in a way that I think, along with arms control and bilateral issues, helped give the Soviets generally, but I think Gorbachev in particular, the sense that we were prepared to work with him as he took the Soviet Union and I think the Warsaw Pact through the dramatic transformation that he had laid out and that the people on the ground were beginning to express.
I'm going to take questions from you all in just a minute, but I want to draw your attention to a Pew poll that has just come out. In fact, it comes out in about half an hour. I think it's embargoed for the next half hour, but we can jump the gun, I reckon. Pew has polled 15,000 people in 13 different European countries looking at attitudes towards unification. And Hans-Dietrich, there's specifically on the issue of Germany, they asked people whether there was still support for unification and found there is still broad support for the collapse of communism, but that there's less enthusiastic support than there was in 91, and that many in the former East Germany still believe that they were overwhelmed by the West, that unification happened too quickly, and that the East still lags behind the West. Does that strike a accord with you?
I think there are many people who are disappointed. For an example, those who had a function or post in the old system, they lost their social position. They will be disappointed. They like to have present circumstances to live. They can travel all over the world. They have pensions higher than they could expect in the past. But nevertheless, they are not no more the bosses, and so they are disappointed. If you look to the young people in the east of Germany, they are aware they have a common future with the West Germans. And many of the young people left GDR, the eastern part, to live in the West or even in Austria, in Switzerland, in the United States. So I think this is not a realistic picture. You can go over the world, all over the world, all the United States. There, people will be disappointed with the policy of a government or what happened to their state. So I think this is not an argument against unification. These are personal assessments. But having the floor, I cannot finish this discussion without saying what great gratitude the Germans feel for the American support in the time of division and in the time of negotiations. This is in Germany unforgotten. And the way how it could made possible in short time to unify Germany would not have been possible without the support of President Bush and my good friend and colleague Secretary Baker. They were very helpful. And mentioning them, I have to include my neighbor to the right.
Brent, when you look back at that time and you look at this Pew poll now, and largely there is satisfaction, but there are pockets of disgruntlement and there are still divisions between East and West Germans and still unemployment levels that are different. Were there things we could have done differently, should have done differently?
I would like to say I think Chancellor Kohl bent over backwards to benefit East Germany in this transfer. There was a huge difference in standard of living and so on. But he pegged, for example, the exchange rate between the Deutschmark and East Germany at a very unrealistic level, which cost West Germany, I don't know how much, but billions of dollars.
How unpopular was one-for-one in West Germany?
Not at all.
It wasn't?
You cannot have in one state two currencies. Yeah. Do you think it would work in the United States?
No, of course it wouldn't. But by giving a ratio of exchange at 1-1 when the GDR Deutschmark was not even close to that.
Yes.
He gave a huge benefit to East Germany.
No, this when we were united, we had one currency.
No, but even in the process of uniting, yeah. He did that. He did that before
the union. We did that 2 months
I'm
before.
I'm trying to be nice to you.
Yeah. Yes. No, I think we had no alternative.
Than 1-1?
Yeah.
Bob,
yes.
You were saying earlier that was one of the most controversial elements of the financial process.
It was controversial among monetary figures. but it wasn't controversial among those people who recognized that ultimately it was a political decision on a step toward a country that was going to unite very soon thereafter. The exchange went into effect on July 1st. The country unified on October 3rd, so there was just that short period of time. And I don't know of anyone who's ever questioned it from a political perspective. I think from a monetary perspective, the central bank, not surprisingly, had some concerns about it. But at the end of the day, I think it was seen overarching a political decision and was part of the cost that was prepared to be paid to have this country united from the start.
And there was a saying in East Germany. This was, the Deutschmark should come to the East. If not, the East will come to the Deutschmark. It was very clear.
Well, but that's another point. I think Chancellor Kohl was farsighted enough to know that the people fleeing East Germany to the West were the most talented people. And he didn't want to impoverish, it was a problem absorbing them, but he didn't want to impoverish East Germany by having the most talented parts of the population go. I think he was very aware of this and did his best to have it a balanced union.
Is there what they call nostalgia, the nostalgia for life in Eastern Germany? Is that something that
Hans
Dietrich was suggesting is just people's?
Could be.
It exists. It's real.
Yeah, but not so much as is reported. You know, I lived in GDR until 1952. I came to the West, so I have many friends in my hometown, Halle. They maybe by chance are happy. Maybe by chance others are not happy. But if you look to the results of the election, of course the left-wing party is stronger there because of the old organizations. But the overwhelming majority is CDU, Social Democrats, and Liberals.
The one other thing
After all, Chancellor Merkel is an East German.
Yeah.
Right. The one other thing I wanted to pick up from the survey was concerns about the resurgence of nationalism in Russia, and that the Pew poll is saying that that is a real concern amongst the people that it surveyed. Brent, is that?
Well, I think it probably is a concern. I don't know how broadly it's shared inside Russia, but I think when you hear Putin, you can see that nationalism welling up. And I think one of the things we overlooked during all this was the national sense of humiliation that the Russians felt at what was happening to them. And I think had we been more aware of that, we might have behaved a little bit differently. We were not trying to take advantage of Russia, but President Putin, at the Verekunda conference, when he sort of declared the Second Cold War, said, when we were flat on our back, you walked all over us. You moved the borders of NATO up to Russia. You denounced the ABM Treaty. You did all these things. Now we're strong again. We're not going to put up with it. You know, that's sort of the outburst of the, I think, sense that the Russians had that we took advantage of them when they were weak.
Even though President Bush, when the wall came down, made it a policy not to gloat. There was going to be no gloating from the White House.
We did our best at that time to say, President Bush said, nobody lost the Cold War. We all won the Cold War. We took the NATO treaty and we went through it and we took out all of the warlike paragraphs and made NATO a non-threatening.
We are no longer enemies.
That's right.
Well stated in Malta.
Absolutely. So, yes, we did. But then we, in the pursuit of a Europe whole and free and all these things, we sort of forgot to nurture, if you will, the Russian sense of, as I say, humiliation.
Every human being has its own dignity, mm-hmm. and the nations also. And
dignity is a better word.
Dignity, yes. For decades, they were a superpower like the United States. And then they came down. And though some reactions have to be understood under these preconditions, and then you will feel better. I think we should try to cooperate with them on an equal footing, not give them the impression they have lost the Cold War, but to give them the impression we want them to have as partners of Europe and the United States. It should be a common objective of America and Europe.
Bob?
Well, I was going to say that I think that concern that Brent raises about Russian reaction did drive, in part, the sort of UN Security Council-based strategy that we used in the first Gulf War that, of course, began even before German unification took place, and that the Soviets and later Russians played a very important role in that process of laying the UN foundation for the coalition action, and there was really nothing that was done without them being closely involved in that strategy, starting with Baker and Shevardnadze, who happened to be in Irkutsk on the day that Kuwait was invaded by Iraq, and really that partnership toward that common effort was very important. And then it was the summer of 91 that Gorbachev was invited to the G7 summit. Yeltsin was there the following year in Munich, and that was the start of the G8 process. So I think both on security, but particularly on some of the economic and financial matters, there was a recognition that we needed to bring Russia inside the club to be part of the group discussing these important issues going forward.
So what happened? Why did it disintegrate then, that sense of cooperation? At what point did we forget that we needed to treat Russia as an equal partner and make sure they didn't suffer this sense of national humiliation?
Well, I think a good bit of it continues. I mean, obviously, you don't do Security Council resolutions with regard to North Korea or Iranian nuclear issues without the Russians being part of that process. You have the NATO-Russia dialogue going on right now. Perhaps it's not as fulsome as it should be, but I think the institutions are still there, and the Russians have continued to play a very important role in the G8 and increasingly in the G20 as it becomes a central organizing body for economic and financial discussions at the leaders' level.
Okay, let me take questions.
May I make some remark, because you referred to the summit in London. Germany and France proposed to invite Gorbachev in order to give him more authority in his own country. But the hosting country, who was in London, is obvious, refused to invite him for the talks and the negotiations and the discussions. He was invited after the press conference for dinner, more or less a social occasion. And this had a strong impact on his position in Russia, because people said, look, you did so much for the West, and look how they are treating you now. You are absolutely right. One should not forget. Human beings have a dignity, but nations have a dignity too.